Jesus save.
Mormon Mental Health is a production of Mormon Stories Podcast and the Open Stories Foundation. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards supporting its listeners. To support the podcast, please consider a donation today at mormonmentalhealth.org. And thanks for listening.
Jordan Compass came from me.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Mormon Mental Health. Today I have the privilege of interviewing Dr. Gregory Hudnall. He is the executive director and founder for a nonprofit organization called Hope for Utah that focuses on suicide prevention. He has a doctorate from the University of Utah in education, also has a master's in education from Brigham Young University, and a master's in social work from University of Utah, and has a rich history working with in education systems and crisis centers, and just a nice mix between education and psychology. So welcome, Dr. Hudnall, to our program.
Thank you, Natasha.
Nice to have you. So why don't you give us a little bit of a little richer history than what I just presented as far as your background and where you come from professionally.
I'd be glad to. So I was a high school principal for 15 years in Provo, Utah, and then had the opportunity to go to the district office and be the director of student services and associate superintendent. Provo's kind of unique. We're the second largest city in the state of Utah, about 120,000 residents. We have a very large university, of course, with Brigham Young University. And we're also the only community in the state that has a state hospital. So we have some unique challenges to our community. While at the district office, I was heavily involved with student services with a focus on suicide prevention because of the experience of losing a couple of students as a high school principal.
Yeah, so that's a pretty profound experience when that happens for you, obviously, as a principal, and obviously for the community at large. So before we go into, I guess, the Hope for Utah organization, this is Mormon Mental Health, and could you share with us a little bit about your Mormon background as far as how do you come to be Mormon yourself?
Yeah, Natasha, thanks. So I actually grew up in Illinois, small rural community close to Nauvoo, Illinois, out in the sticks. Our branch was probably 15, 20 miles away. My father joined the church, so I'm a second-generation Mormon. Served a mission to the Nevada Las Vegas mission. Met my wife at Ricks College and then moved here to Provo. And so I've been a member of the church my entire life and have had some great opportunities, including being an LDS bishop and serving with Truman Madsen in some stake leadership positions and just some great opportunities to work among the saints.
Hey, that's wonderful. Yeah, so let's get into Hope for Utah. Kind of explain to us what this organization is about and how it came to be, and tell me a little bit about maybe what led you to feel like this was an organization that might be useful or needed in the community that you serve.
As a high school principal, I received a call one early a.m. in the morning when Provo Police Sergeant contacted me, and they had actually identified a body in the park next to my school. And the young man didn't have any identification on him whatsoever. So they asked me to come down and help identify the body. And I remember to this day, you know, and that's been almost 20 years. What I wore, you know, it was cold out, went down to the park. They had it roped off. They had the spotlights and everything. And when I got down there, the sergeant asked if I was going to be okay. And I said, yeah, I think so. And went over and identified the body, handsome young 14-year-old who had leaned against a tree and had taken his life. Actually had to move the body so we could identify him. when I got done, went back to my car and literally just threw up. I sat and sobbed for over an hour. It was so traumatic. And I remember sitting there holding the steering wheel thinking, you know, this is crazy. You know, we live in a great community with great resources from mental health to other things. And, you know, I just kind of made a vow right then that I was going to do everything I could to prevent suicide. Mm-hmm. So from that experience, I sent out a call, an invitation to providers in our community, including mental health, the local hospital. I got a representative from Brigham Young University, private providers, law enforcement. I sent out, I think, 32 invitations and 40 people showed up. And we sat around and had lunch. And my question was, basically, what are we going to do to prevent suicide? And how do we stop our kids from killing themselves? And so from that, we actually put together a task force, and it was called the Utah County Hope Task Force. And it was amazing. People really rose to the occasion. We put together what we called our Circles for Hope, which is the community working in tandem with the mental health agency with a focus on the schools. Research shows 7 out of 10 kids will tell a friend that they're depressed, suicidal, or whatever, but never tell an adult. So we really focused on, first of all, educating the community, and we've trained over 19,000 residents in Utah. What are the warning signs, how to talk to our child or talk to a young person, and then where to go for help. And put together a community crisis team made up of all volunteers. And so we started to see some success. We were averaging one to two suicides a year in Provo from 1997 to 2004. So we started to see some success with what we were doing. We go out on Sundays, do presentations, firesides. We, you know, all religions, Catholic Diocese, Assembly of God Church, Baptist Church, etc.
And Mormon Church as well.
And Mormon,
I'm assuming.
Yeah. Our highest numbers, of course, are the LDS Church. Mm-hmm. We do Fifth Sunday presentations so that a lot of bishops will have us come in and they'll do the combined Relief Society and Elders Quorum and High Priesthood and Relief Society come together and we do a 50-minute presentation. We do a lot of firesides with training stake adults, so from camp leaders to scoutmasters to young men, young women leaders, etc. So we started to see some success, but we were still missing some pieces. And so the final piece is what we call our Hope Squad. And we went into one of our largest high schools right next to Brigham Young University, which, by the way, had a high percentage of threats, attempts, and completions. And we went into to the students and asked every student, went through the English classes, if you were struggling emotionally, needed someone to talk to, list three of your peers that you would feel comfortable with if you were struggling emotionally. And it was fascinating. We collected all that data, and what we found was the same 40 names rose to the top. And they weren't necessarily the most popular kids, but they were the kids that you just love to be around. You know, non-judgmental, very supportive, willing to listen to anything. So we started training those students. What are the warning signs? How to intervene, and when to go to an adult when you're worried about a peer. We went from averaging 1 to 2 suicides a year. We haven't had a suicide in 8 years.
Oh, that's hugely significant.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive.
And is this, when you say there's no suicide, are you speaking about adolescent suicide or suicide all?
So focus was on adolescents, mm-hmm. and now we're taking it to the community. But our focus, Provo School District, 14,000 students, 9th largest district in the state. And so our focus was on those 14,000 students, because that's where we found, you know, the suicides that we were losing were our students. So the success has been within those 14,000. We haven't had a suicide in 8 years.
Wow. And this young man that you were called to identify at the beginning of your story, is that you were called to identify because he was a student from your school, or they assumed that he might be? Is that?
Yeah.
And he was.
So, and that's why they called me down, because they had assumed that because he was in the park. And he was this handsome young freshman.
Yeah. Well, that's really a significant success. So tell me a little bit about how you've gone about connecting with specifically LDS churches and organizing some of these trainings, whether they be through actual, you know, Sunday church services like Fifth Sunday discussions or firesides, or, you know, how, do you do that through bishops or stake presidents, or is there some type of, higher up type of leadership that you've been in touch with to try to get these things organized?
So we actually, it's been fascinating, Natasha, because, our original idea was just to stay in Provo, and now it's really taken off, and that's why we've now created Hope for Utah. Most of our calls come from young women presidencies, young men presidencies, scout leaders, individuals that have had a suicide. They've either met with police or gone online and found us. We have met, actually talked with secretary for the presiding bishop, Brick, and had a great discussion with them. And then we actually met with Brother David Warner, who is in church office building on the 20th floor, who's responsible for all the priesthood for the church. And so mostly now we get calls from bishops and stake presidents. Next three Saturdays, stakes are having a mental health awareness day, where they bring in different providers and different resources, and we're going in to be keynote speakers to talk about the signs, what to look for, how to talk to your child. A year ago in January, KSL, which is the largest communication, Bonneville Communication in the state of Utah, contacted us. They had done a story on a suicide and actually hadn't gone very well, so they invited us up. We trained them, Deseret News and all of their writers, reporters, etc., on actually how to report on a suicide to prevent a contagion or copycats. And so just a few weeks after that, KSL contacted us and said, you know, we had no idea, because Utah is the fifth in the nation for ages 10 to 17 for suicide. And so first time in the history of KSL, they canceled the news in April on a Thursday night. And they had come down and spent a couple of days with us, with our students in the schools, with some parents who had lost a child. And they did a 30-minute series on suicide in Utah. Mm-hmm. And once that hit the news, our phones haven't stopped ringing.
Wow. So obviously people are recognizing the need for this. And once they find out about your organization, they're hungry for that type of training to occur in their area, it sounds like.
Yeah, very much so.
And so it also sounds like the bishops and stake presidents who are inviting you to their congregations are, it's kind of like a bottom up type of approach, that they recognize a need within their own stake or ward for whatever reason, and then they reach out to you.
It's really a grassroots kind of thing, which, you know, to be quite honest, we have found it most successful, because it's not mandated or anything that way. And it's people that are really responding to a crisis or wanting to prevent it. You know, late last night, I got an email from a Relief Society president that, you know, she basically said, you know, my bishop's very concerned. We've had two attempts. We had a 13-year-old that just went into the hospital. We're trying to find resources. Would you be willing to come and help us as a ward? So those are the ones that we get weekly.
Right. And how big is your team? Because obviously, you know, you can't be all over Utah every day.
Yeah, you'd be surprised. I've put on 25,000 miles on my car.
Oh, wow.
Last 4 months. But so we have a team of there are six of us, and then we have a support system. It's pretty cool, Natasha, because what we've been able to create in just this 6 months, we have 1,700 volunteers across the state that are involved at either the school level or the community level. We have five cities that have adopted our model. And in fact, the state of Utah Health Department has chosen our model as one of the premier models for the state that they want to help. So we're in St. George, we're in Ogden, we're just now moving into Pleasant Grove and Duchesne, and of course we're in Provo and then Kanab.
All right, so let me go back to this. This was fascinating for me to hear that, you know, when you go into a school system and you ask the kids, you know, who are the people you might speak to if you needed help, and out of an entire school, the same, you know, however many thousand kids, choose 40 kids that are in common. So how do you manage? Because, you know, that is, I think you're speaking to personality traits, right? Like some people are just good listeners and, you know, just kind of naturally people are drawn to them. That's a lot of responsibility for those 40 kids, right? To kind of, how do you go about talking to those 40 kids in the sense of understanding that, you know, they're playing a role, and at the same time, it's an important role, and it also probably at some level is unfairly an adult role that now they're playing as adolescents themselves.
You know, it can be a challenge. We were out at Saratoga Springs last month, and our programs are called Hope Squads, and they had three schools do a combined parent night. And so there were about 60, 70 kids on the stage, and they were kind of talking about their program. And a couple of things stood out. One, they talked about that since the first week of school, they've had over 29 referrals where they have actually gone in, either taking the student into the counselor or had the student follow up, and they had three kids hospitalized. So we know it's working. Interesting enough, I had a mother come up to me who actually is a nurse in a psychiatric unit up at the University of Utah, and her son is the president of the Hope Squad at this middle school. And she said, you know, she goes, I have two things. She said, the first thing, I just want to tell you how I'm so impressed with this organization and this club, you know, this Hope Squad. She says, it is so powerful, and I see the difference it's making in my son's life and other things. She said, the second part is, I'm a little concerned because he's starting to feel that he's responsible for everybody. And it's hard for him to let go.
Right, and
that was a good thing for us to learn, and we talked about it. And one of the first questions I asked the mom, I said, well, let me ask you a couple questions. The first question is, if your son wasn't a Hope Squad member, how would he be acting right now? And she started to tear up, and she said the exact same way. She said, that's his personality. He's the kind of kid that goes out and brings home the little puppy dog or the lost child or whatever. I said, so that's what makes your son so perfectly designed for this program. What we have to work together, i.e. the school counselor and you as the parent, is now starting to teach him appropriate boundaries and understanding that he's not a therapist, he's not a counselor. And that's what we train the students. So every month there's a 40-minute training that the students go through, and there we call in phases, peers helping advance suicide education, and we train them on the warning signs. We train them on how to talk to a peer, the do's and the don'ts. They actually identify the teachers that they're most comfortable with taking a peer. We teach them about keeping themselves mentally healthy and the importance of that. We teach them boundaries. What's the appropriate boundary? You know, so there's a lot of things that we teach them. One of the phases is they go home and teach their parents a family home evening, a get-together, where they train their parents on what it means to be a Hope Squad member and how the parent can help them be most successful. So it's, you know, it's pretty exciting, but you're right. It is a challenge, and some kids really rise to the occasion and do really well. Some of the other students, you know, take it on so much. And at that point, we advise the school counselor to meet with them, find out if this is the best thing, and to make sure that the Hope Squad members are, you know, are always healthy.
Yeah, and I think you make a good point that some of these kids would be like this anyway, you know, and so it's neat that they're getting training as well on, you know, how to, like you said, have appropriate boundaries, how to know what they need to take on, what they should not take on, right? So, which they probably would have been having these types of chats or things with their friends anyway, so it's good for them to hear that type of education.
Yeah, I think that's what this mother was saying. When I put it back on her, you know, the question of, well, help me understand what Johnny would be acting like if he had never heard of Hope Squad or wasn't a member. And, you know, she kind of put her finger to her mouth, and she was sitting there, and she teared up, and she said, you know, the exact same way he's doing now. And so your point, Natasha, is right on, because what we try to do now is to give them the skill set on how to be a successful peer-to-peer mentor and supporter. We, you know, one of the, I show a slide when I do a presentation, and it shows 100 little stick figures in line with each other, and they're all in white, and then one is in red. And I talk about the specific that you are chosen by your peers because of who you are. We don't want to change that. We want you to continue to be being who you are, and in return, learning how to help your friends. So you're not going to be a therapist or a counselor at this time in your life. Maybe you will someday, but at this point right now, we want you to be who you are.
That's great. So it is, I think, a bit surprising when, especially those of us who are LDS, hear that Utah is number 5 in the United States for youth suicides, you know, suicide ages 10 to 17. Because we obviously pride ourselves of, you know, to be a good community resource, and, you know, we have the gospel to help us in life, and, you know, all these things that, you know, we feel are positives and assets to being a Mormon. And not that all of these kids who are committing suicide are Mormon necessarily, but they're living within this very, you know, large Mormon culture and resource community. So, and I also know it's difficult to come up with reasons why, you know, kids commit suicide to begin with. But as you've been working, obviously, in the Utah area and kind of understanding maybe what are some of the contributing factors to this, do you have any insights on why this might be the case, or what are things that are going on, particularly in this state, that might contribute to this statistic?
You know, it's interesting. I was invited to testify before the United States Surgeon General on suicide in Utah. They pick one or two people from every state. Joyner, who's one of the premier researchers out of Florida, talks about how since 1999, suicide is the only illness, if you can call it that, as we do, a mental illness or whatever. But he said it's the only thing that continues to increase while everything else is decreasing, from cancer to polio or, you know, whatever it is. And, you know, the research, the top 10 states have always been Western states for the past 20 or 30 years. And there's some things that play into it. Number one, of course, is the rural, the isolation. You know, the state of Utah is actually a pretty large state, but we only have 3 million citizens. And, you know, you can drive from one end to the other end in, you know, 10 or 12 hours, and you'll go through 8 major cities, and that's it. Right. The rest of it is spread out across the state. So the second part of that is the concept of lack of resources. Alaska, Nevada, North Dakota, Wyoming, you know, all in the top 10. And, you know, we have very little resources to put into mental health support. I remember one year our local mental health agency announced that they were having to let go 100 of the families that they had been working with because of I think it was Medicaid, but the cuts in Medicaid, could have been Medicare, but Medicaid, I think. And I see and hear that all the time. We're kind of the Wild West. Utah and the Western states are top 10 for gun ownership. And unfortunately, we're quite proud of that. And the research shows it's not gun ownership, it's accessibility to those guns when someone is depressed. And then the last one, Dr. Doug Kondo out of the University of Utah, has done some fascinating research on altitude, where the research is showing how oxygen mixes with the blood differently in altitude levels, much different than in lower areas, and how that affects depression and individuals that way. So, you know, I think there's a variety of issues. I always get the question, Natasha, of, well, you know, all of these top 10 states are high LDS membership. How does that play into it? And I think it's a fair question. And what the research shows us is that belonging to the LDS church, or for that matter, any other church, is actually a resiliency factor. And it's that support system that you get being my brother or my sister's keeper. And, you know, you think of the things that we do. We LDS church tends to, you know, as members, we live our religion all week long, not just on Sunday. The challenge is if you fall out of that norm. And that's the difficult part. We tend not to be very forgiving. I think we tend to be a little more judgmental because of our beliefs, our high expectations for ourselves and for others. And when you fall out of that norm, it's no longer a resilience factor. It's actually very difficult.
Can you give me some examples of what that might
be,
falling out of the norm?
Yeah, so falling out of the norm in our culture would be a student who's struggling with his sexual identity or her sexual identity, a young person who has had to repent of something. You know, you would hope, and I know this is the way it's supposed to be, is that when someone is going through some personal challenges that, you know, we would reach out, put our arm around them, tell them how much we love them and that we're there for them. It doesn't always happen that way. And sometimes, you know, like right now, you know, the numbers are showing 8 to 10% of our missionaries are coming home early. I hear comments from, you know, other parents, you know, to their daughter. I know this is your boyfriend, but I'm not going to allow you to date him because he came home early. I've even heard parents tell their kids, don't come home from your mission unless you come home in a body bag. You know, if you come home early, you know, it's those shaming and those guilt terms that are used out there that I don't think we realize the negative impact or what it's really saying to our youth. But it's difficult.
Yeah. So if you don't fall in line, then somehow either other people won't want to hang out with you because maybe you're a bad influence or you're not meeting the standard that people want in their lives, or your own family kind of deals with their anxiety in really harmful ways around those issues.
Yeah. Joyner talks about that in order for an individual to take their life, he talks about the concept that there are a lot of attempts, and that's what the research shows. For every young person who kills themselves, there are 30 individuals who attempt that end up in the hospital. And there's another given 100 students who may attempt that we never know about. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, so the challenge is, you know, how do we help those kids? And Joyner talks about the concept that it's actually called, he says there's three pieces. The first piece is isolation. I feel that I'm all alone. The second one is that I'm a burden. I'm an embarrassment. I'm a burden to my family. I'm a burden to society. And then the third part is that ability to kill themselves. And, you know, it's fascinating research and information. That's the challenge for us. within our, you know, communities. But if you look at adults, you know, our numbers are just as high. And Joyner talks about the concept that, you know, we've created this situation within our society. And it's not just LDS, but I think it's difficult for LDS because too many times we tend to shame our children or shame one another. But, and I'm speaking mostly about families, you know, my child struggles with, you know, if I'm a parent and my child's struggling with pornography, instead of realizing that it's just my kid struggling, we tend to own it and we're afraid it, you know, that we're going to be embarrassed and people are going to find out about it. And then too many times we try to shame our child into correcting that behavior. And what I have seen in a lot of situations is that it, because of the addiction and how difficult it is, it's not that they quit it. They just do a better job of hiding it from mom and dad.
Right. So you start that kind of fear, shame, secrecy cycle, right? That
yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I'm afraid because I did something wrong. I feel bad about it, and I'm not going to tell anybody about it, which exacerbates that isolation piece, I think, that you're speaking to.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Truman Madsen used to talk about it all the time that, you know, one of the things that we need to remember is that this is a journey and that we're all going to make mistakes, and that because of the atonement, the opportunity to repent and other things, that, you know, this life is an opportunity for us to learn and to grow, and that it's enduring to the end. And too many times we think that we have to be perfect now. And if we're not, then people won't like us, or, you know, we won't be accepted, or we're not meeting the standards of my next door neighbor who's the Relief Society and has the perfect hairdo and the nicest kids and yada, yada. Where the reality is that Relief Society president has just as many struggles as everybody else, but may do a better job of hiding it.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. So it's tragically ironic because in a culture where we covenant to bear each other's burdens, and, you know, as part of our baptismal covenant, we're not so great at that from two perspectives. One is sharing our burdens because, you know, we're afraid or shamed or, you know, wanting, and I mean, granted, some of our burdens are private, but, and secondly, as the receiver, it's easy to be judgmental or afraid of the influence of people who are struggling, you know, and I think all those things play into really this isolation piece for many of us.
Yeah, you know, that's exactly right, Natasha. I was a very young bishop and raising our four kids under age eight out on the farm, and one time a colleague of mine came out to get me, and I had just been in an argument with my son, and there was yelling, you know, yada, yada, and the doorbell rings, you know, and here's the person standing at the door, and I know, you know, he heard me yelling and different things, and we're walking out to the car, and instead of being embarrassed or whatever, he kind of put his hand on my shoulder and said, "Tough day, huh, Greg?" And it was like, yeah, it really was. Thank you. And I you know, I think we struggle with wanting to be perfect and not being and going through that. And I feel for our kids. You know, one of the biggest challenges with suicide is the kids that do it based on academic or athletic performance, et cetera. And so in the back of their mind, you know, they have to be perfect, so they have to have perfect grades, and they have to look perfect, and different things that way. And when they get a B+, they feel like a failure. Mm. And it's interesting because you could take 100 kids and put them in a room, and every one of those kids that may struggle at some point in their life would find a different avenue to suicide. So it's not like I have an uncle who's a medical doctor, family doctor. And, you know, he could sit down with me, take my blood, my cholesterol, do everything else, and within a short period of time, he could say, wow, you're in this percentile for being at risk for, you know, whatever it is. And it's so much more difficult with suicide because probably 60% of all suicides occur within a 24-hour window. You know, I disappointed my family. We had a young man that had got caught stealing something at school, and he was an outstanding young man. No signs whatsoever of depression. That night took his life. You know, I could tell you story after story. A student body president, all-star wrestler, came from an amazing family, was just given a full ride scholarship to BYU and some other things, killed himself. So, it's a challenge for us in our society.
Yeah, and going back to kind of some of the issues within LDS culture is what you were speaking of these high expectations, which come with a lot of pros and cons, right? I mean, it's great when we have goals and things that we're aspiring to, and I think this idea of eternal progression can be quite healthy, you know, in the sense of there's always more to learn, there's always more to experience. But where it really can go drastically sour is this idea that, you know, if, you know, I'm looking at pornography or I'm masturbating or I'm LGBTQ or whatever it is, you know, I'm stealing something, that we oftentimes forget that it's not a permanent condition. That's not true necessarily with sexual orientation, but I'm saying what we do, our behavior, you know, is not a permanent condition, and that there's lots of options. And the anxiety of parents or even leaders that, oh, now their life is irrevocably, you know, altered, you know, in that sense that things will never be the same. You know, if you've lost your virginity, for example, or things of that nature. And I think it's just so unfortunate that we don't have a healthier relationship with our mistakes and our sins, as seeing that as part of the plan and part of how we learn and grow and become challenged and gain empathy. And it's hard for us to talk about sin in any positive way.
You know, I think you're right on. Just last Sunday in my high priest quorum, the teacher made a great comment, and we actually talked about it. He was talking about his grandson's baptism, and, you know, the lesson was on covenants and baptism, et cetera. And he talked about, he said, you know, sometimes I'm jealous of the Catholic Church. You know, they get to go into a box, confess their sins, and then move on. And, you know, I really took his point to heart, because that's really what the sacrament is for us. I mean, if you really look at it, that weekly communion with our Heavenly Father is that weekly thing. But it is so difficult, and it's so much different for us. And, you know, I think it's in, Spencer W. Kimball's Miracle Forgiveness. I think I remember reading it there, but it was something to the point of, you know, I'm a prophet of God, and I have to repent every day. And if I'm the prophet and have to repent, think what you have to do. And it was like, wow, right on. That's exactly right. But it's that mounting fear, that embarrassment, that shame that goes along with it. And I think, you know, most bishops are pretty good about, you know, helping individuals, you know, through that process. But it's a challenging process.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about what you know specifically around these kids of ours who are LGBTQ. I've heard certain statistics that I'm not sure are currently accurate, in the sense that we have the number one suicide rate in that population in the country, in Utah. And I've also heard quite a few concerning statistics about kids getting kicked out of their home when they come out of the closet, per se. Are you aware of any of that type of either research, or what's going on for those kids?
Well, we do know in the state of Utah that the number two individuals that are most at risk for depression or suicide are the LGBT kids and our Native Americans. Now, in fairness, when you look at those numbers, the Native Americans, of course, is because we have such a huge population and land that the reservations are part of. LGBT kids, you know, I'm not specifically I haven't done any research on it. I'm aware of the research, and it shows we're very high, very, very high. And what we have found in our training and in our research across the state is that one of the number one reasons is because these kids are bullied so bad by their peers. We had a young man, this was years ago, a junior high student, that was really picked on and really bad by his peers. And they had actually gone to a church activity, young women church activity. And when he got done, he came home and dad was sitting in the chair reading the newspaper, and he walked right by his dad, went downstairs, got a gun out and killed himself. And we actually were involved meeting with the parents afterwards. And I had one of my colleagues who's the director of psychiatric care for IHC, Dr. Ken Tuttle. We were meeting in this parent meeting, and this father really started to get after me, saying, why isn't the school district doing more to prevent this? And finally, Dr. Tuttle interrupted, and he said, "Well, sir, let me ask you a question. Do you have a son or daughter that goes to this school?" And he goes, "Yeah, I have a son." And he said, "Well, did your son know this young man?" And he turned to his wife, and his wife said, "Yes." And Dr. Tuttle said something to the fact of, "Did your son ever bully this young man?" And this gentleman's wife started to cry. So you could tell that it had happened. And Dr. Tuttle said, then why didn't you do something about it as a parent? You know, why is this a school issue? This is a parent issue. And so what I see, Natasha, with the high percentage and talking to my colleagues across the country, it tends to be in very religious areas. So it's not just LDS. It's happening in other communities across the country. But it goes back to that issue of stepping outside of that norm. And, we don't know how to handle it. It's one thing to, it's what I used to tell my kids when we had some friends that were non-LDS that smoke and drank, and they were our dearest friends. And one time one of my children said, "You know, Daddy, we're the only kids that are allowed to go over there and play with them." And I said, "Really, why?" And they said, "Well, you know, because they smoke and drink." And I said, "Those are bad habits. Those are not bad people." And it's the thing that I think we tend to forget. We may not agree, we may not, you know, even like what that individual is doing, but I think President Hinckley did a great job of teaching us that we still love the individual.
And being more accepting of all different types in our communities, and whether they adhere to same standards that we adhere to, right? It's and things that we think are bad, other people don't have those same beliefs, right? And so we miss out, I think, when we limit ourselves to only those that we're comfortable with.
You know, I was chairman of the city council one year, and we have a big event called Freedom Festival, and big parade, and they have a fireside Sunday night every the closest Sunday to the 4th of July, and it's at the Marriott Center. And, usually the prophet comes or one of the apostles, and this year it was actually President Hinckley coming. And they had kind of a pre-meeting, and it was down in the basement, and, you know, they had food set up and everything. And here were all these LDS leaders from, at that time, regional reps to mission president, temple president, and state presidents and everybody. And I was there from the political arena, as was the mayor and governor and stuff. And then there was a group of seven or eight non-LDS. The Catholic father was there, Reverend Jackson, Assembly of God Church, you know, all of these other non-LDS ecclesiastical leaders. We're all waiting for President Hinckley, and in walks President Hinckley. And on the right is all of this group of LDS and local politicians and who's who. And on the right were these other denominations. And it was fascinating, Natasha, because right through the door, President Hinckley walks in with his escort, and he turns to the right and recognizes us and kind of smiles, and then immediately goes to the other side and starts meeting with these other church leaders. And at first I thought, wait a minute, I want to shake the prophet's hand. But then I stepped back, and I was so touched by his tender mercy and his true love and respect for those individuals that, you know, he spent the first half hour with them. getting to know them, talking to them, visiting with them. I was deeply touched by them.
Yeah, what a great example.
Yeah, it was.
So let's go back a little bit. You had mentioned gun ownership as part of, you know, something that we need to consider. And again, not that gun ownership in and of itself is negative, but it's oftentimes a means used for suicide. Do you have some knowledge about what are the most common ways if an adolescent is going to try to take their lives? I've heard that things such as, you know, males might be more successful than females because males tend to use more, effective means such as, ammunition. Girls maybe will be more likely to take pills or something of that nature. And do you have any information on that in regards to what are some of the means that people use?
Yeah. So here's what the research shows. For every young person, for every young man who takes his life, there are four females that have attempted, so it's 1 to 4. But because of the methodology, just like you said, that males tend to use guns and hanging, females, it used to be in the past that it was more pills and then cutting. A great study, it's either Harvard or Yale, did a study on four states, and Utah was one of the states, and it's actually showing that hanging has increased suffocation, and in the state of Utah, suffocation has actually become number one past guns. But the accessibility of guns is what the concern is, and we work with families and communities, and one of the things that we try to help educate them is that, you know, if you have a child who may be struggling or a family member, get the guns out of the home for right now. Give them to a trusted friend or, you know, do something that way. We actually have a bill, legislator Steve Eliason sponsoring a bill right now. I've had a chance to go up and testify a couple of times, but he's sponsoring a bill on providing better gun locks to families. And our organization did one in partnership with Provo Police Department and the NRA, where we gave out 300 gun locks so that, you know, you have your cabinet, but this is an extra trigger lock. And, you know, the perfect example for me was at the beginning of every school year, we first started out back in 2003 training every district employee. So our focus was every teacher, and eventually our goal was to get every custodian, lunch lady, bus driver, everything on what are the warning signs, how to listen to a student and reach out to them, and how to refer them for help. And this young man had been referred to the psychologist because of something that he had written in his class. And the youngest that we've dealt with, Natasha, is a fourth grader who hung himself. So, you know, anymore, you know, we're literally working all the way down to first and second grade kids that are dealing with depression issues, et cetera. But
that's so important to you know, point out is that we think oftentimes of depression and anxiety as adult disorders, but it can start very early.
Yeah, very young. So here was this fifth grader, and the psychologist brought him in and found out that he had a plan. He had accessibility, which we call a high risk, and got the dad on the phone. And in fairness to the dad, he said what most parents say: my son's just doing it for attention. Well, the wise psychologist said, why don't you go downstairs and look under your son's mattress? The dad went down the stairs and looked in his son's bedroom under the mattress, and there were 7 .22 bullets. And the dad said, where did you get those? And the young man said, well, when you take me and my brother out target practicing, you lay the boxes, the bullets on the table, and we reload our rifles, and when you guys weren't looking, I've been putting one or two away over the past few weeks. And the dad said, well, to the psychologist, he said, well, he may have had access to the bullet, the ammo, but I keep my guns in another closet, you know, locked off. And the wise psychologist turned to the young man and he said, what's the combination? And the young man said 8, 10, 12. And the dad said, how did you know that? And he said, well, about 6 months ago, we were bringing the guns back in. You had me hold the guns while you bent over doing the combination, and I've just remembered it. So my point, and I use that story a lot, is that why we think our guns are safe, they're usually not, because the accessibility is where the opportunity becomes that when that individual is depressed, they react and then they have the ability to take their life.
It's amazing how smart our kids are, isn't it? As far as
amen to that.
Yeah, being able to pick up on things that we would never guess.
Yeah, that's right.
How often do we know why a certain individual has taken their life? How often, in other words, is there a note left or an easy answer, or a lot of parents and community members left really kind of very confused and just, you know, utterly just, I mean, it's devastating no matter what, even if you know the answer, but how often is that a factor of not knowing why?
You know, the biggest challenge for us, and it's probably the most frustrating for everybody. I've been involved now with over 30 suicides, 9 or 10 as a first responder. So I was there with the body and law enforcement. And very rarely do you get a note, probably less than 20%. And that's what makes it so difficult for research. And a lot of the research is showing that about 60% of youth who take their life do it within a 24-hour window. They're responding to a crisis, you know, a bad grade in their mind, a romantic breakup, a disciplinary action with an adult or whatever. And so it's so difficult because there is no note. And even in the ones that I've been involved in with the notes are pretty much a, sorry, I disappointed you, you know, and parents are going, you know, wait a minute, this was a 3.95 GPA all-star athlete. What do you mean disappointed me? And so the notes sometimes don't always help to give us the clues that may lead into it. 30 to 40% of the suicides are, you know, long-term mental illness, and you know, if they stay on their medication, they do well. If they don't, then, you know, it's a problem. I was presenting yesterday at the state hospital and talking with 50 of their psychiatrists, medical doctors, therapists, etc. And you know, they deal with the difficult mentally ill kids and adults. Those are the most challenging to try to stabilize, but I think the most difficult deaths are the ones that are done within that short period of time. And a lot of times when I've met with the parents, they will say, I had no clue. I literally had no clue that my son or daughter was depressed.
And that's what can be so incredibly damaging to those left behind, right? Is all the what ifs and what should I have been looking for and how could I have prevented this, and just the blame, the self-blame, and just questions. And there's just, it's such a difficult thing to have closure on.
It is. In fact, my wife is a therapist for the VA, and her name is Melinda, and she does a really good job with these returning vets. And she kind of explains it, you know, when you lose your best friend and you go through that survivor guilt or whatever, she says it's like this big boulder on your shoulder, and it's like it's this most consuming weight, and you just feel like you can't carry on. And then she says, once you start getting the skills and the ability to deal with the anger and the blame and the depression, you start realizing that the feelings never go away, and nor do we want the feelings to go away, but you learn how to channel them. And then eventually it's like having this small rock in your pocket. And, you know, every once in a while, you don't feel guilty because you don't remember them every second. But when you grab that rock and that fond memory comes back, then, you know, you're grateful for that individual, but you've learned how to survive and to live within your life. And it's hard. I can't even imagine the difficulty of being a parent and losing a child that you care so much about. I've been the external side of it, and it wipes me away emotionally, so I can't even comprehend it.
Okay, I'd like to move into maybe having you share some more specifics about the training that you offer. Is that okay?
Yeah, sure.
So you've mentioned several things as far as I think one of the main things that you are educating people on are what are the warning signs. You know, when there are warning signs, because there aren't always warning signs, like you've mentioned. What are things that people should be looking for, or things that should raise a red flag, or things that might be concerning?
Yeah, so for us, what we try to train is the parents what to watch for when they notice behavior changes. So, you know, for example, with church members, I will teach them or train them, you know, start to watch the changes in your child. If you see them go through a difficult time and they respond, you know, emotionally, crying a lot, blaming themselves, you know, I'm so stupid. Comments like, you know, my family would be better off without me. I'm at the end of my rope. You know, comments and changes in behaviors. With depression, we see it. Kids will stay up all night, and then they're so tired that they'll sleep all day. You'll start to see sometimes even changes, you know, with friends, where they're no longer hanging out with their friends or being involved or anything that way. Sometimes within that 24-hour window, we try to train them, you know, to watch your child and how they respond if there's a breakup, you know, with a boyfriend or girlfriend. We just lost a beautiful young lady, a junior. Her boyfriend broke up with her. Within 5 hours, she drove out to the park and took her life up Provo Canyon. Three or four of her friends knew she was going to do it, but no one ever told an adult, you know, and it's not that she came out and said, I'm going to kill myself, but it was just the way she was acting and the comments that she was making. We had one young man who took his watch off and gave it to his best friend and said, I'm not going to need this after tomorrow. And his friend said, well, what do you mean? And he said, well, I don't care anymore. Life is not worth it to me. You know, comments and different things that way. And that's why it's so important that, you know, why we spend so much time and energy with the youth leaders, the coaches, the scout leaders, the young women leaders, the young men leaders, and others. It's kind of that old African proverb that says, you know, it takes a village, an entire village, to raise a child. We believe it takes an entire community to save one. Because in most of the cases I've been involved in, the parents had no clue. They had no idea. Now, after we've, you know, talked with them and they've seen our training, they will say, oh, yeah, I should have recognized that. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't like it was blunt and it had been going on for a long period of time.
Right. Yeah, and most people aren't saying things like, I am going to kill myself, right? It's more veiled than that. It's difficult to pick up on because, you know, most of us have bad days. Most of us have bad moments. And so we'll say things like, oh, you know, today's awful. Or, you know, and so how do you know when... That's yeah. Just normal kind of difficulty of managing your everyday life versus really something that that can be much more serious than that.
Yeah. You know, the interesting thing, and it's a presentation that we're just starting to develop, and that is the concept that we really need to change a couple of things. One, Joyner talks about, you know, the CDC came out in 1999 that said violence on television is as closely related to depression and suicide as smoking is to lung cancer, as what's the painting is to brain damage, you know, the we used to paint the inner city homes and stuff and the high rises, lead paint.
Lead paint, yes.
And the reason, you know, it finally came out that the kids were eating it, chipping it off the wall and stuff. It is so critical in our society. So you see that, and then the second part of it is that we've got to start teaching our kids that resiliency factor. I talked with a colleague. He's a church leader, and he was talking about the number of kids that were coming home early from their missions, and these are not bad kids. And a lot of them are not coming home because they're depressed or, you know, I mean, they may be a little depressed or whatever, but, you know, we're not teaching our kids how to work, and we don't want them to have difficult experiences. I think the guy's name is Klott, K-L-O-T-T, a researcher, but he talks about the concept that we really need to back off. So when our kids have negative experiences, we allow them to work through it instead of trying to save them from the pain. And it's one of the things that right now in my presentations, I try to teach parents that it's important for your child to have that experience. And while it's hard, you know, to see him crying or thinking, you know, that, you know, it's so difficult, they need to know that you're going to be there, that you're going to be there to help them and to support them, but you're not always there to fix everything. Because our kids don't know how, a lot of our kids, with the technology and other things, they don't know how to work through difficult issues. I see it in the schools a lot. And these are bright, bright kids that you love and admire. You know they come from good families, good LDS religious families. But then when they get into a crisis or a situation, they don't know how to deal with it.
Right. Well, it's kind of this challenge because I think we almost fetishize happiness, right, in our culture at large. And so it's this idea of, you know, we're constantly wanting to be happy or everything should be fine. And so, yeah, when problems come up, it's everybody's anxiety goes up or it feels like you shouldn't have those issues. And one thing I try to educate people on is everybody has symptoms of depression or anxiety without it becoming clinical, you know, because that's supposed to be a part of life. And how do we manage those issues before they do become clinical, right?
You're exactly right. And that's those areas that we're trying to teach. And the problem is the parents don't deal with it. We want everything right now. I was in a school last year, I think it was last year, the year before, but it was like a third grade class, second or third grade class. And, you know, there were 22 kids in the class and like 20 of them had cell phones. And you look at this iPhone, the iPhone has as much technology as the standard computer did 7 or 8 years ago. And yet, what are we doing? We're buying every kid a computer. I've unfortunately have had to go into some of these rooms after a suicide, an attempt, you know, or whatever. And you know, I walk into this bedroom and here's a computer on the desk. Here's a television on the wall. Here's their iPhone. It's like kids are being given anything and everything without having to work for it. And I think it's hurting us.
Okay, so you talk about, you know, so maybe you start recognizing some warning signs, right? And you start becoming, your red flags go up and now you're concerned. What's the next step? You talk about how to listen. You talk about referral. You talk about, you know, what if those things start kind of prickling at your mind, like, ooh, something's really wrong here. What should a person do next?
Well, I think the most important thing is that they need to have the courage to ask their child if they're okay. We're afraid that asking someone if they've thought of hurting themselves or if they're suicidal will give them the idea, when in actuality the research shows that's the best thing we could do is ask them. On this KSL special, they interview me about how to talk to my child, and so I go step by step of what to do and actually act it out and give an example. And the next within the next couple of days, I got a call from this individual that actually came and met with him. I'd never met him before, big Hawaiian guy. And he said, you know, Greg, I just want to say thanks. And I said, well, what do you mean? And he said, I watched it on television. And he said, my son is an athlete, and he had hurt himself, and he hadn't been able to play. And he goes, I know he was depressed, and I was very, very worried about him, but I didn't know how to talk to him. So he finally said, I finally got the courage and went into his bedroom and shut the door, and we're sitting there just kind of hee-hawing. And finally my son said, okay, Dad, what's up? And his dad laughed, said, what do you mean? And he goes, you don't come into my bedroom and sit down and talk with me like this. And he said, you know, I was watching this thing on KSL the other night, and it was on suicide and depression. And one of the things that they talked about is always asking your child, and I'm really worried about you. You know, have you thought about hurting yourself? Are you suicidal? And he goes, Greg, you know, that was probably the best discussion I've ever had with my son. He said, we talked for 30 minutes. And he said, when he got done, my son turned to me and said, Dad, I'm depressed because I'm not playing football, but I'm not depressed enough to kill myself, but two of my friends are, and I'm worried about them. And he said, I was able to call those other kids' parents and let them know what was going on and the concerns about it. And so my point is, you know, you see those signs, you're worried about it, in a private moment, pull that child away from everybody else so you're not doing it in a situation where you're going to embarrass them. But in that private moment, just ask them, you know, Sally, I don't know how to ask this, but I'm really concerned. And some of your behaviors are showing me that you're dealing with a lot of pressure and depression. And, you know, have you thought about hurting yourself? Have you thought about suicide? I've literally, Natasha, I've gone knee to knee with hundreds of kids through the years, never met before, referred to me by a teacher, principal, counselor, parent, bishop, you know, you name it. And within a short period of time, I've asked them, you know, have you thought about hurting yourself? And in many, many of those cases, the kids will kind of look up and go, how did you know? And then I'll say, well, you know, a lot of times when people write the comments that you wrote in your journal or on your paper, you know, Mrs. Johnson referred me to you. She had heard you talking about it in the hallway, that a lot of times when kids say these things, they've actually thought about suicide. And then, you know, what I find time and time again, and what the research shows, kids don't want to die. They just want the pain to go away. And they don't have the ability to make the pain go away. They don't have the life experiences, et cetera. And so in too many times, that suicide becomes an option.
So if you sit down with your child and have this, like you're talking about, very important and difficult conversation, and the child or student or whoever it is starts opening up and saying, yeah, you know, I have been thinking about that, or I'm scared, or, you know, whatever it is, what at that point are good directions that you can give as far as what then? What? Because then now, you know, probably the parents' anxiety is even higher. Like, oh my goodness, there really is something here. You know, so what do you do now?
Yeah, now I'm stuck. What do I do? You know, that's a really good question, because what we try to train the parents is that at that point, you know, you hug them, you know your child better than anybody. And so then you become that support system. And a lot of times it's something like, I don't know what to do. I'm scared, but let's figure this out together. Let's call brother so-and-so, you know, he works for the mental health agency, or sister so-and-so is a therapist. We tell parents, if they have a plan and it's serious enough, take them to the emergency room. Don't even think twice about it. Let the experts look at them. You know, we're very lucky where we live, because we have community crisis teams. Just last Sunday, I was actually called out to a BYU student who was a freshman at college that was having a lot of issues and had swallowed a lot of pills and was at his girlfriend's apartment. And it was fascinating. I wish I could have videotaped it, because this was a great young man, 4.0 out of high school, from back east, just really successful, but struggling with, I think, depression enough because he felt that he wasn't performing at the level he should be. And, you know, be quite honest, BYU, just to get in, you have to have amazing grades, et cetera. And so I think he's now among the competition, where back home he might have stood out as the top 5% of his class. Well, all of those top 5% come to BYU. And so, you know, he had swallowed all these pills. And I said, okay, help me understand, you know, what you were going through, what's going on. And he said, you know, I'd actually, you know, had a razor blade and I was going to, you know, cut myself. And he said, but that was too painful. And he said, the emotional pain is so overwhelming. He said, one of the only reasons I didn't kill myself is I didn't know how to say goodbye to my family, my mom and dad and siblings. He said, but I can't go on like this. He said, it's suffocating me and I just can't take it. So we were able to get him hospitalized and, you know, he was able to get the help he needed. But going back to your original question, it is the next step is not letting them out of your sight, that you're grabbing them and letting them know that together we're going to figure this out and that I'm here for you. I may not understand what you're going through, but, you know, parents, don't ever say, just get over it, suck it up. You know, you'll find another girlfriend or boyfriend, because that's when the kids feel like you're really not listening to them. And the best thing we can do is say that, you know, that must be really difficult for you. And I'm so sorry you're having to go through this. Let's figure this out together. Let's, whether, you know, we go to the local mental health agency, you know, I'll go with you, and together we'll talk to someone that might be able to help us. So that's how we kind of coach the parents along.
Yeah, that's great. We had a situation here in our state just a few years ago where one of the girls at girls' camp kind of shared some suicidal ideation with one of the other girls. And so that girl came and told, you know, one of her leaders and did the right thing. But then there was the consequence of then that original girl who was struggling kind of wrote her off as a friend. In other words, you tattled on me, right? So do you have any ideas or thoughts about, you know, the fear that some of these adolescents might have about, you know, turning their friends in, per se?
Yeah, it's hard. And that's what the Hope Squad members go through, because a lot of the kids that they reach out and help are their peers. And it's one of the things that we talk about. And we were doing a town hall meeting in a community one time, and pretty little girl was out in the audience and she raised her hand and she said the exact same thing. She said, my best friend has told me 2 or 3 times that she's going to kill herself. And so then I said, so what have you done? And she said, I'm afraid that if I tell anybody, she won't be my friend anymore. And so it was a great teaching moment. And we talked about the concept that, you know, the reality is that if you don't get help for your friend, she actually may try, and it may actually happen. So you have a choice as an individual to either get help for her. And, you know, she'll be angry. She'll be angry at first, and she may even be angry later. But what we have found in most situations is that once that friend becomes healthy, they usually come back and say thank you. And in a lot of situations, it is, you saved my life. You know, you really, you know, thank you for having the courage. Now, that doesn't happen every time, and unfortunately, you know, friendships are lost and other things, but what you can feel good about is that you had the courage and the ability to get help for them when they were resisting help. And that's what you have to look at long term.
Right. And it also speaks to, it's not fair to carry that burden all on your own as the friend, you know, to be worried and again, taking on a lot of responsibility by what's being shared with you and then feeling like you can't, real, you know, tell an adult, because it's really an adult's responsibility to step in.
And that's where we teach our Hope Squad members about boundaries and that, you know, you're breaking that wall of silence, but you're not owning the behavior. What you're doing is getting them help. And it takes a lot of courage. It takes a lot of confidence and courage to step up and, you know, and to get help for that friend of yours. And it is hard, and we know that. We recognize it, and it's why we're so proud of these kids. You know, when, you know, so far this year we've had 135 referrals, and I think we're up to 13 or 15 kids being hospitalized. So we know it's working. But yeah, it can be a challenge at times.
So going back to something you said, as far as I think a sentiment that many people feel, especially with what I'd consider more chronically problematic kids. In other words, they've been dealing with depression or bipolar or something along their lives for a long time. And so they're continually talking about taking their life. This isn't something that just happens, you know, solitarily. And then you do get the perception that, well, they want attention. This is another way to, you know, kind of get us to all get worried about them. What are your thoughts about how to manage that type of adolescent and how we can reframe it into a more healthy way than just they're seeking attention?
You know, I struggled with that at first, but what I've come to realize, and this is how I basically approach that. And in fact, I just had one about 2 weeks ago where a mother and father stayed after the church meeting and came to me and said, you know, we've been struggling with our son for, you know, 2 years now, and medication and other things. And, you know, every once in a while he'll say, you know, I'm going to kill myself. And we think he's just doing it for attention. And one of the things that I use, and some people disagree, but it's something that I have found to be very helpful, is that I sit down with that child and say, you know, the one thing you need to understand is that as a parent, I never want you to hurt yourself. And that child may be doing it just for attention or whatever. Okay. But I'm still going to get him help, because even saying that, even if it's just for attention, something's missing in that child's life for them to do that. And what we have to do is figure out how we can help them. And is that possible in every case? No, especially with the mentally ill that refuse to take their medication or, you know, whatever that way. But I'm still going to push it. And one of the things, I had a young man that I was working with, and I said, let me help you understand something. When you walk into an airport, what is one of the things that you cannot say? And he looked at me and he said, well, I have a bomb. And I said, yeah. And I said, why is that? And he said, because people have blown up planes. And I said, yeah. And I said, what happens when you make that comment? He said, you're surrounded by the police and probably arrested and all these other things. I said, yeah. I said, well, guess what the comment is that you can't say in school and not expect something to happen? I'm going to kill myself. That is one of those terms that we have to take seriously, because we've had too many individuals kill themselves. And so you may really not mean it, but the reality is we're going to take it serious every time. And that's what I tell the parents. And it does overwhelm you. And bless their heart that, you know, this is my 17th time to the emergency room or whatever. I get that. But I still want that child to know that it's something I'm going to take serious.
Yeah, and that's... I completely agree with that. I tell my clients as well, it's, you just, every time that happens, it's the same consequence, you know, and not that we're punishing the kid for saying, I'm going to kill myself, but that they understand that there's a consequence to that statement, that we're going to, as adults, take seriously in their lives. And even if it takes, you know, 300 times for them to get that message across, it's worth doing that.
Yeah. Yeah. That, and I have found that to be most successful. It breaks your heart. You know, I have had those parents, Natasha, that are dealing with serious mental illness issues. And
which is exhausting.
And it just breaks your heart. And, you know, you listen to, you know, they're up every night and, you know, dealing with these situations. And, you know, it does. You just feel for these parents.
Yeah, it's very complex. I'm kind of at the end of the things that I have thought to ask. Is there something that I'm missing? Is there something that you would like to share as far as maybe something I haven't asked you about or that you want to hit on?
you know, probably two things, Natasha. One is an overview of our program, because, you know, we think our model is really good. Like I mentioned, the state health department has chosen it as their number one. We call it Circles for Hope, and it's the community coming together. So it's all of us reaching out to try to save that child. And then the second part is the Hope Squad. You know, we're now in 39 schools, and by springtime, we hope to be in over 50, with our goal 100 next year. It's a pretty simple thing, but it's amazing, you know, how successful it is. And, you know, at some point, we hope that, you know, it will be in other places and not just in Utah.
Yeah, and so to that point, if somebody's, you know, because this is a nationwide program, well, international really, is if somebody's interested in starting up a similar type of resource, such as Hope for, I'm sorry, say it again, Hope for.
So Circles for Hope.
Circles for Hope and Hope for Utah. So how would they reach out and ask for help in learning how to develop something like this themselves?
So all they'd have to do is contact us at hopeforutah.com. So H-O-P-E, the number 4, Utah.com. Our website, they can get information on it. There's a link to contact us, and then we would just send them information and try to help them.
Good. Okay. Can we close with whatever, I guess, you would like to say to those parents and friends where the suicide wasn't able to be prevented? Can you close with some thoughts as far as, you know, coping or just your experience of what it means to heal from something of that nature?
You know, I don't think there's anything, there could hardly be anything worse in life than losing a child or losing a family member to suicide, especially when, you know, it is such a complex situation. You know, I take heart by Elder Holland's talk in our last general conference. I take heart by what Ezra Taft Benson has said and other general authorities that, you know, the Lord will take into consideration everything that was going on in that individual's life, and that the Lord is the judge, not us. And in the end, I believe that the Lord will be quite merciful because of that depression, because of the mental illness, because of the challenges that led that individual that wanted to get rid of the pain and saw suicide as an option. I believe there's hope. I also believe that suicide can be prevented if we work together and, you know, be our brothers and our sisters' keeper, that we can provide that support and help and do all we can. And to those that have lost children and family members, know that there are others that understand your pain and agony and grateful for a loving Savior that that we all can turn to.
Yeah, that's something I really appreciate about, I think, how Mormon doctrine has been clarified, because there's no worse way to interpret the gospel than to now assume that your child will not be able to join you in an eternal family unit because of suicide, right? And so I think we have a lot of, including, I believe, even Joseph Smith, people who have assuaged those types of feelings, you know, that this is something that does not, you know, stop the atonement from working on, right? And so to not start using the gospel as a whipping post in the sense of this means that we can't be an eternal family, that we have no jurisdiction over that type of judgment.
Yeah, and that's where, you know, I am so grateful that judgment is the Lord's. Not mine, it's not my next door neighbor's, but it's the Lord. And you know, our loving Heavenly Father will take all of those pieces into consideration when, you know, that judgment is made. And I think it will be a brighter hope for the family and for the child, because I do believe in most situations that they'll be able to be together in the next life.
Well, thank you so much for your time and for your expertise on this very important subject and for all the work that you're doing in your community and the state at large to, you know, help individuals and family systems and community systems to deal with such an important issue. I would like to just mention that for those of you who are listening, we always appreciate donations to the Mormon Mental Health Podcast series. Those donations help to continue our attempts to cover the costs of creating the podcast itself, and we are very grateful for your listening to these very important topics. And with that, I will close and say thank you again, Dr. Hendel, for coming on our show.
Natasha, thank you, and thanks to everybody.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Mental Health. To discuss this episode, please check us out at mormonmentalhealth.org. To keep the podcast alive, please consider a donation today, again, at mormonmentalhealth.org. Logo was provided by Daniel Singer. Music was generously donated by Lower Lights. Please check them out at thelowerlights.com. And thanks for listening.
Chart and compass came from thee, Jesus saved.